Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. State health officials believe the next few weeks could be a critical time in the effort to slow down the spread of the coronavirus in Vermont. That's because there should be signs by the middle of December if most people followed the state's guidelines of not participating in multifamily gatherings over the Thanksgiving weekend. Governor Phil Scott is urging Vermonters to follow these health guidelines, and he says he sees a light at the end of the tunnel.
I know how hard it is. I know how hard it will continue to be as we make our way through the holidays without the normal get-togethers and sense of closeness we all want. But with the recent news on vaccines, we now know there is light at the end of the tunnel. We will get through this, and we can see there are brighter days ahead.
With us today to give us an update of where things stand is the state's Deputy Health Commissioner, Tracy Dolan. Tracy, great to have you back on the program.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Tracy, maybe you can give us an update of where things stand today. Maybe 10 days ago or so, we had 148 cases in one day in Vermont. There was another day where there was 146. The number dropped to the mid-40s. Then it went back to the 80s, and now we seem to be in the mid-60s. Is this sort of the trend line that we're on? Do you think we'll be able to stay pretty much where we are?
You know, we're really hopeful that with Vermonters doing more of the cautious behavior that our governor laid out in the executive order, that we won't see the surge that we're hearing about in other states. Of course, with Thanksgiving, we know that some people did gather together. We're hearing that. And so while we expect an uptick there, what we're hopeful of is the balance of other people staying home, staying small, staying within their in their households will balance that out. Again, hard to say, and certainly nationally a surge is predicted, and I don't think Vermont will be immune from that. However, we are hopeful that these lower numbers are a new reality for us. It's certainly a reprieve right now to see some of the numbers coming down. Again, hard to predict, but we're hopeful that Vermonters took this really seriously and that even though some people did get together, that a lot of people didn't. So we're hoping that the surge on the surge that Fauci talks about doesn't happen here, and maybe instead what we have is a more moderate surge, hopefully.
Some people might be wondering, can you make a direct connection between those days we were at 146 and 148 cases and trace it back to Halloween?
Yes, we can. I mean, as direct as we can, obviously. You know, epidemiology is a very valuable science, but it has its limits. But for the most part, we're able to look back and see actual situations or outbreaks that are related to parties and other events that went on around that time. And then we're able to see the increase in cases. And of course, with the interviews that we do, and those are in-depth interviews done by case investigators, we're able to literally hear about where the source was and how the spread happened. So for the most part, I would say yes. Can we tie every aspect of the surge to it? Maybe not every aspect, but overall, we are seeing that those informal gatherings certainly had a contributing effect to the surge that we saw.
So how much of a time frame do you think you need to tell about what happened over the Thanksgiving weekend? Do you need 10 days or so?
Yeah, about 10 days. Some people who do, if they begin to get symptoms, will probably begin to get them even within a few days. So what we may see is people getting symptoms, going in for a test and getting that result even sooner than 10 days. I believe Dr. Levine said pretty much in the next couple of days, we should start seeing what we think would be the impact of any people who were getting together. And again, it's not just about the day of Thanksgiving. It might be people getting together before that because they had people travel in or after that. And so as much as we focus on the Thanksgiving day, the message, of course, remains throughout. Please stay within your household in terms of contacts, unless, of course, you're an isolated individual living in one person in a house, then really just connect with that one other household. But that really needs to continue throughout. There's nothing magical about the day of Thanksgiving. We just know that that's a day that more people would plan to get together.
So let's just review for folks what they should be doing based on what they did last weekend. If a person did travel out of state for part or all of the Thanksgiving weekend, do they need to quarantine when they come back to Vermont?
Yes, they do. They should be quarantining, and they should also be seeking a test. So quarantine, and it would be a good idea if you've traveled to seek a test as well.
And if a person had family members or neighbors over for any event during the Thanksgiving weekend, the same idea would apply?
Yes, we're recommending that if you did gather and if you were unable to adhere to the governor's order and you did gather, please go for a test. It will really help us. I actually assisted on some contact tracing last week, and it's amazing the kind of information you can get as you speak to people. It's a really good opportunity to be able to speak to people, remind them of the quarantine. So any testing and then a positive result that comes in allows the health department to know about you, to reach out, and then to do the contact tracing to try to contain anything that may have occurred as a result of that gathering.
You've mentioned a couple of times people should quarantine either for 14 days or 7 days and have a negative test. What's the magic with the 7 days and the negative test? Why does that work?
What we're finding from the data is that by 7 days, most people, if they are going to become ill or if they are going to become infected after exposure, most have become infected by the seventh day, well over most. So we're not capturing everyone. It's possible that you could be exposed on day zero and then on day seven have a negative test. And then if you were tested again on day 10, you may have a positive then, although those numbers are smaller. Normally by day seven, if you are going to become infected, upwards of 70 or 80% of people would show infection by then. So it allows people to get out of quarantine early. It still captures most of the cases that we would see if a person were to get infected.
Let's start off with Larry in Ludlow. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I greatly appreciate it.
Sure. What's on your mind today?
Well, I had a question regarding the tracing protocols as far as households, family members, close acquaintances getting together around the holidays and previously to this. Where does the testing stop? I understand that families are contracting it from other family members, but where did they initially get the virus? I mean, people are traveling across states without question, and we have an influx, especially in Ludlow, of non-residents coming in to enjoy the mountain skiing. I wonder if it has been looked into to see if that is perhaps more or less the reason that the residents of Vermont are contracting the virus, if I put that correctly.
Sure, I'm happy to answer. So I think it's a mixture. We do know that even without travel, we have some virus present here in Vermont. However, when you don't get together, you don't see it transmit as much. And so it may not be as apparent. When people start getting together, even though our infection rate or our positivity rate might be only 1.5%, I think when CDC does antibody tests, Vermont tests lowest of all the states. So the actual amount of people who have been infected or in the case of current infection, is very low compared to the other states. But if you get together, then that virus moves that way. So that's one way it happens domestically. But of course, people traveling in or Vermonters traveling out and coming back, those are two other ways for it to enter. And so it's really difficult to say that it's mostly due to travel, because we certainly know that, for example, at all these Halloween parties we talked about and other events, travel wasn't necessarily a big feature of those outbreaks. When we did case investigations, often we would not find that the cases had actually traveled. They had simply been together. So the source is here, even though it's in small numbers, but it's when we get together and it starts spreading that we see those numbers pick up.
Larry, thanks for your phone call. Tracy, we have this tweet from Joseph who asked the question, any chance you could ask the state if it has any plans to engage with Apple and Google on the COVID notifications built into the iOS and Android operating systems?
Sure. I actually asked that question of our Agency of Digital Services last week. They have looked into it. They're continuing to monitor it. They're checking in with other states to see how it's going. That might be most effective in states that have a higher positivity rate. Right now, we are still able in this state to be able to interview every case, to be able to follow up with contact tracing. We may use technology in the future to enhance that, but right now, we are not pursuing that right now. However, it's on our mind, and we're keeping an eye on it.
How exactly would that work?
You know, I don't know much about it. I know that my digital services friends know more about it, and I believe New York is using it. I think it's a way for people to be aware if they are near a case, I believe. I believe that's how that technology works.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Elizabeth in Cambridge. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yes, my question is, I encountered somebody in a local store the other day who was not wearing a mask. So I had questioned it, and he said, well, I have a condition, and he was, you know, kind of nasty about it, too. What is the recourse for that? And who do you call? Because I've run into quite a few more of the smaller stores that they just don't adhere to the mask. People just walk around freely without wearing masks, jeopardizing everybody else. So who would you report this to?
Thanks for the question. And you're right. When people are not wearing masks, they really are jeopardizing others. Now, there's a handful of people who may have a particular health condition and they can't wear the mask. And what we encourage those people to do is to minimize the amount of time or to have somebody else go, ideally, out into markets. So there may be a handful of those people. However, the vast majority of people, including almost every healthcare worker, of course, wears masks, who wear masks, you know, for their whole shifts. We believe most people can tolerate a mask, even if it's uncomfortable. We don't have a reporting mechanism per se. What we do instead is we do some spot checks on stores. We're pursuing that right now. And I believe that there was a form on the ACCD website where people could write in let folks know if there's a particular store. But we don't have a clear public reporting mechanism for that. Or if we do, I would need to do a little more research and get back to you.
Elizabeth, thanks for your phone call. Tracy, we got this tweet from Mary, who is actively involved with her church and has a few questions about churches and singing in a congregation. First, she asks about congregational singing and whether it's allowed, especially without masks and distancing, and whether or not masks are required or recommended in a church setting, and whether youth groups and Bible studies should meet in person or virtually. And also, we had just at the same time a tweet that came in from Diane, who wanted to know if you could clarify the parameters for outdoor caroling. But let's go back to the first one so we don't merge them all together. What about singing in church?
Singing in church. So that's a great question. I don't know if we have guidance particularly around singing in church. Certainly, you should be wearing a mask when you're in church, and you should be distanced. Singing inside, we know, is higher risk than singing outside. And there was certainly a significant case of a choir that gathered early in the pandemic where more than half of the choir participants after a rehearsal became ill with COVID and some actually passed away. So in general, singing inside is higher risk. Singing with a mask is better. And I'm not going to speak more to that because I don't know if we have guidance beyond that, except to say that it is not the lowest risk activity to sing inside. Two things you could do to mitigate that would be to spread out and to wear masks. But I'm not certain if we have guidance beyond that for the actual singing inside. I can speak to caroling. So I love caroling. So this one's close to my heart. Again, outside and spaced would help with masks. I would say outside, spaced with masks would reduce the risk of caroling versus close together without masks.
it would reduce the risk. Is it something that you would discourage?
I'm not going to say that right now because I don't know if we're going to have more guidance that comes out around different types of holiday activities. So I'm going to hold off on whether or not we'd recommend or not recommend. I can tell you right now what activities would reduce the risk, but I probably will hold on that answer until we get a little more information about what we want to advise around the holidays coming up.
Let's talk to Rebecca, who is calling from Waitsfield. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Deputy Commissioner Dolan. I'm calling because I'm a little bit confused about some of the governor's most recent guidance. I'm looking at the text right now, and I'm calling because my mother-in-law lives alone out of state, and her plan was to quarantine, I think, even for 3 weeks, and then come and be with us for the holidays. But the text I just read yesterday said, visitors to Vermont cannot gather with Vermonters or with people, blah, blah, blah. And then down at the bottom of this bullet point, it says, even if they have completed a quarantine, they may not gather with another household in Vermont. So would her visit not be permitted under the current guidance?
Yes, you're right. Under the current guidance, even if somebody quarantines in advance, if they come into Vermont, they cannot gather with another household. And that's a really hard thing to hear around the holidays. And we'll see if that changes in the coming weeks. But currently, because of the surge and because of the concern nationwide for the uptick in cases, and because we're seeing more people hospitalized, and we've even seen an increase in fatalities for all of those reasons, we have some very strong restrictions. So right now, somebody coming in from outside of Vermont can come here and they can quarantine, but they cannot get together with people who live here in Vermont because that is a multi-household gathering, and that is currently prohibited by the executive order.
Tracy, I have to admit to being a little confused. I thought I heard in the most recent press briefing just about an hour ago, a question came up about someone who wanted to come to Vermont and ski, and could they quarantine at home for 14 days and then come to Vermont? And the governor said he didn't think so, but then Secretary Curley said, actually, a person could. So does it depend on if you quarantine at home for 14 days? Does it matter of what your activities are when you come to the state? Am I missing something here?
Yes, it matters what your activities are. If you're coming to the state and getting together in a social gathering with other households, that's the part that's prohibited. If you do the quarantine piece and you come here and you're not gathering with others, that's what's allowed. And so I know that it doesn't feel as consistent when you think about the ski industry, but the idea would be, again, somebody quarantines for the 14 days, comes here, they ski, but they don't gather and engage in social gatherings with other households here. So they're not staying with friends here. They're not getting together for dinners here, having parties here. They're skiing, and then they're staying on their own in a separate lodging.
Let's turn to Alex, who's calling from Vergennes. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me. My question is a little bit about contact tracing. I'm confused about contact tracing for individuals who are asymptomatic. I understand that if you are asymptomatic and you have a test, contact tracing happens from 48 hours backwards from the test. My question arises because I've seen some evidence in my community of some individuals with COVID who they had a positive case in their household that they were not aware of at the time because test results were pending. And then other members of the household were in the community unmasked around several individuals because they didn't have their test until several days later. All of those people they were around were not grouped into the contact tracing sweep. So, for example, I've pulled my children from school because I'm aware that they had contact with some of those kids. So I just want to understand a little bit more about how it's determined to do contact tracing for those who are asymptomatic. Thank you.
Sure. I think what you might be describing is a contact of a contact. And that's where we do not give guidance to the contact of a contact. So the key is the case. So the initial case is interviewed, and we determine from that case who has had close contact. Then we reach out to those close contacts, and based on what we learn from them, either from onset of symptoms or from when they were last exposed that they know of, then we determine what their quarantine period is. And so for those folks, they are home during their quarantine period, either for the full period or they may test out. But if those people were in touch with other people, we don't go so far as to say, okay, now anyone contact that you were in touch with is now someone who also needs to be quarantined. So we don't go to that second, that third generation. We talk to the first case and then the contacts. If one of those contacts becomes a case, then we restart. We interview them. We find out who they've been in contact with. And that's how contact tracing works. So we contain case by case. What we don't do is treat every new contact as though they're a case.
Alex, thanks very much for your phone call. Tracy, there was an interesting article in the Atlantic Monthly that I think reached a conclusion that said if the public feels that there are a lot of inconsistencies in a health department's rules and regulations, that it can undermine the public's credibility and trust in the health department. And I'm just wondering, you know, we just talked about if somebody wants to come from out of state, they need to quarantine here for 14 days and the whole how it compares to skiers. And, you know, there might be some people who are thinking here, geez, I can't have somebody over for dinner in my house, but we can all go to restaurants. Do you think there's some inconsistencies there that need to be addressed?
I think there may be some inconsistencies in our rules, but those that you just spoke of aren't inconsistencies from an epidemiological standpoint. There are reasons that a rule might exist in one place, but it's different in a different environment. I think if you're a member of the public, that can be sometimes tricky to understand. And our job as the state and as the health department is to try to explain it as well as we can. So the difference between going to a restaurant with your family is that you are still really just one household going out, sitting at a table, separate from everyone else. But the real key is we really rely on the data here in Vermont, which is part of why we've been somewhat successful compared to a lot of other states. So the data that we have tells us that for the most part, our situations, our outbreaks, our cases are actually not coming from people going to a restaurant, because there the rules are followed well, they're maintained within their own party, and they're not mixing. It's really these other environments where people come into each other's homes, they're more relaxed, they're less likely to wear masks. And because you're relaxed, because you know Bob and Bob seems healthy, that's actually where our transmission is happening. It's not happening in more formal environments where there are clear rules for the most part.
And if I understand the data correctly, it's really not happening in schools.
Really, for the most part. I mean, you might have a positive case in schools, but it's fairly rare that that positive case then transmits to another person. And again, in part, we don't see children as a driver of transmission generally. But secondly, kids are wearing masks. I mean, of all the people who have been great about mask wearing, I would say school kids are among the very best. Teachers are wearing masks. Everyone is really conscious of the separation that they need to do. And so for all of those reasons, and now we're seeing with the teacher testing, the surveillance testing, that the positivity rate among teachers is also very low. There's a lot of things that are really protecting that environment.
And could you help us understand, is it true that students are less likely to pass it on to another student than adults would be?
That's what our data appears to show, and that's nationally what the data shows right now. We don't know if that's because kids already just have a lower positivity rate, or if there's something about the way children interact, or something about the age, perhaps, that affects transmission. But the data tells us now that children are not a significant driver of transmission.
Let's talk to Judy, who's calling from Colchester. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. My question today, I'm a Colchester resident. We have a small pub that is in Colchester, and I understood Governor Scott had closed bars within the area. And I'm wondering how to help this business understand how important it is to come to compliance. I did do some research called the health division that handles licensing. They stated that the bar did have a restaurant license. However, the bar does not serve food as a rule. They have one option they offer. because so many other bars are closed, this little neighborhood pub has become very, very popular. There are often many clients outside smoking, no mask, not social distancing, together in large crowds of 10 to 12. The same token, because we live in the neighborhood and our neighbors as well, never see any of these individuals that are drinking quite a bit wearing masks. I've called the police. They've just shared that it's really not our concern, that they're just following up, watching nightclubs in the area. The health department did state they would call the owner and let them know there was a concern. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on how to help them understand the importance of compliance.
Thanks a lot for the question, you know, and somebody asked earlier, and I'll try to give a more thorough answer now. I got a little more information. So the governor's executive order, this Be Smart, Stay Safe, it's really mainly done through education and voluntary compliance. And for the most part, that's been relatively successful. So when we do, if we do find out about a significant situation, sometimes someone from the state, it could be from the Department of Health, it could be from the Agency of Commerce or Public Safety, first reaches out to re-educate. And to encourage voluntary compliance. However, somebody can go online and report, and that's through the Department of Public Safety. And sometimes there is follow-up through that, depending on the situation. If you have a complaint or concern about a restaurant, you can go to the health department and go onto the online sanitation complaint form. We do have inspectors, public health inspectors at the health department, and as part of their restaurant inspection, if they see something like that, they will certainly speak up. But it is difficult to capture and enforce compliance in every situation. And what we're most relying on people to do here in Vermont is to do it voluntarily. Some people may feel comfortable going up and speaking to an owner themselves. Some people may not. Myself, I've been in stores before and spoken to a manager. Now it helps that I'm in the position I'm in. And sometimes I'm even wearing my employee badge, which helps. And so sometimes people will very quickly say, I'm gonna get on top of it. So that's one way you can do it. But if you're not comfortable doing that, we do have a couple of other avenues. But really, primarily, we've relied on education and voluntary compliance. And we have seen, and many businesses have told us that when they put up signs, they see an increase in the number of people wearing masks as they come in.
Tracy, that's one thing I think a lot of people have problems with is, or it's difficult for them to do. If you go to a store, and I must say in central Vermont where I live, I think I see almost 100% compliance with wearing masks inside retail outlets. But if you happen to go to the supermarket and you see someone without a mask, even though the right at the door it says you've got to wear a mask to come into the store, some people feel a little uncomfortable going up to someone and saying, hey, you know, to protect everybody, you really should be wearing a mask.
It's true. And it's possible that that person has a health condition, which makes it difficult for them to wear a mask. Again, there aren't many health conditions that probably result in that, but there might be something we don't know about. The bigger picture to look at is in a grocery store, if there are 75 people in the store and one person isn't wearing a mask, that's still relatively low risk if you're spreading out and everyone else is wearing a mask. Now, if that person is sick, obviously, that's a significant issue. If they're coughing or sneezing, that increases the risk. But generally, the risk is still relatively low. Not ideal. Obviously, we want everyone wearing a mask. But just to let you know, keeping it in perspective, if one person in a large group isn't wearing a mask, they're increasing risk, but the risk hasn't increased significantly for that whole store.
Let's go and talk to Bill, who's calling from Stowe. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. I have a comment and then a question. My comment has to do with the 14-day quarantine arriving in Vermont or the 7-day and then a test. I don't think it's emphasized enough when these options are put out there that the individual must remain in quarantine until they get the results of the test. Hello?
So thank you. You're right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, we certainly emphasize that when we do our contact tracing phone calls so that people understand you have to wait to get that result. Because, of course, sometimes on day 7, even if you feel good, you get the result and you're positive. which means, of course, then you have to isolate. So really important point. And so, you know, we try to keep telling people you can test out on day 7, but you have to be in quarantine the entire time until you get that result. And then, of course, only if that result is negative can you be released from quarantine. So that's a great point. Thank you for reminding folks.
And Bill, did you have a question?
Yeah, my question is, I live in a condo complex in Stowe off the mountain road, and I have seen on an ongoing basis people coming Friday night, going out into the community on Saturday morning, and obviously they're not quarantining for 2 weeks. I noticed also this past week, a week of Thanksgiving holiday, that private homes along the mountain road had cars in them from out of state, specifically New York and Massachusetts and New Jersey, and they were there, and then they were gone Monday morning. So they're obviously not quarantined either. And is there anything that can be done about that, or is this something that we just have to accept?
That's a great question. Of course, we rely, for the most part, for all of this, on people doing the right thing. We try to put out our rules as clearly as we can. And you know, individuals, we generally, it's probably not very successful to report individuals because we're unable to follow up in that way. But we do everything we can to try to encourage people. I think that's all we can do at this point.
Tracy, what kind of rules apply to folks who have a second home in Vermont? So maybe they live in Massachusetts, New York, or Connecticut, and they have a second home here, and they're coming up for the weekend. What kind of rules apply to them?
So for people with second homes, really, if you are coming to Vermont from another state, you need to quarantine. You can quarantine before you arrive if you come in your private vehicle, but you're not an exception because you have two homes.
Let's talk to Katya, who is calling from Waterbury. Hi, Katya.
Hi,
welcome to
you?
The program.
Hello.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. I was just wondering if the side effects are, you know, some of them as bad as they say, is there a strategy to stagger vaccination for healthcare workers so they're not all, you know, calling out sick the day they get, or the day after they get vaccinated?
Oh, that's a great question. So phase 1A of our vaccine plan does call for vaccinating healthcare workers. However, we're probably not going to be able to vaccinate them all on the same day. There's a lot of healthcare workers in Vermont. So I think logistically it will be somewhat staggered anyway. But I think I'd have to check in with the vaccine team. I don't know if we've gotten so far as to name the days and the staggering this early. You are right. There could be some side effects. The side effects appear to be somewhat minimal, but they are there. And we know the vaccine is very effective so far, and we know that it's gone through many trials. But logistically, already we know we won't be able to vax everyone on day one who's a healthcare worker. But that's a great question, and hopefully on another show we'll have a little more information about how we will schedule that out.
Tracy, do we know how many doses of this vaccine Vermont is going to receive in perhaps 3 weeks?
I don't have that number with me. I do know that the way they're allocating it is by population, not by positivity rate or need measured by some other factor. So it is about population. And so they will give us a portion based on our population.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Grace in Montreal. Hi, Grace. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. My question is about my siblings and I'm in Montreal. I have two siblings in the U.S., each in separate states, and we've rented an Airbnb in Vermont. So we would, all three separate families would be coming together just for 3 days after Christmas. And we, as far as what we understood from the owners of the Airbnb, that if we quarantined in our own households for 7 days and then had a negative test, that it would still be okay for us to get together. We would not be seeing families that live in Vermont. We would just be coming there for those 3 days. Is this possible?
That's a great question. Just to clarify on the quarantine before you come, I did note earlier that you can quarantine for 14 days before you arrive in Vermont. However, that's only if you then take a private vehicle and have no real overnight stops on the way. So just a clarification there. You individually could come and quarantine and spend time here. However, I think this is a little trickier one. Now, you'd be coming and you would be mixing households from other states. You wouldn't be mixing with a household in Vermont. But I think the principle is still the same, that you'd be coming here and you would be gathering with multiple households in Vermont, even though the households aren't from Vermont. So unfortunately, I believe under the current governor's executive order, a gathering like that would be against the governor's order because it is a multi-household gathering, even though it's not a household that is native to Vermont.
Tracy, you get to answer a lot of questions with almost, you know, lots of variables in them. And what if this and what if that? And we really appreciate you being able to provide us with this information. I know it's not easy. Let's talk for a moment about the situation with testing over in Barrie, where the tests had to be discarded because it sounds like they sat in a parking lot somewhere in Massachusetts for over 2 days. What do you think the state learns from an incident like this?
Well, that's a great question. For the most part, you know, in order to really do testing properly, you rely on a lot of partners all through the chain. So you rely on partners to do specimen collection, for supplies, for courier, for lab. And one of the partners that's really important in testing is the courier. And normally our couriers, you know, get the job done. They understand the timeline. It sounds like somehow there was an error made and the courier, which I believe was UPS in this case, had a significant delay from the time that they received the samples to the time that they arrived in the lab. The good part of this story is that the lab caught that and was able to ensure that we didn't have incorrect results and was able to reject those results, specimens, so that we did not have unreliable results. Of course, the negative part is that people who needed a test went, got a test, and then found out that their test wasn't processed, which is frustrating. And of course, it could make people very nervous about, well, what is my health status? So I think we learned that we really need to figure out if there's a way to increase the quality check on every part of the supply chain. In this case, it's a courier, but we are looking into that now. Maybe there's a way to have more eyes on the process every step of the way so we can track. Again, we have tested thousands, literally more than 100,000 people in Vermont, and this is the first time we've had a case where the results went bad. Where the specimens were too old to be tested. So we've had a very high success rate, but even when the numbers are low, those are real people, and we're certainly concerned for them and feel badly about what happened.
And, of course, some of those people are upset that their emails were all included in the letters that went out from the health department. So everyone who had a test that was not inaccurate, but that couldn't be used, they now have their name out there.
Yeah, so that email went out. Ideally, that would have been a blind copy or some other way to communicate. And I think in a hurry to let people know what the situation was, there was an error made, a clerical error, and of course that had an impact on people feeling like now others know that I've sought out testing. And so again, the Department of Health extends a huge apology for that, and we will double check our quality assurance on our end to make sure that doesn't happen again. You know, we've had hundreds of thousands of tests, and we've had, no breaches in this way, and so we will make sure that we find out a good process and make sure we get more eyes on any information that goes out so that it doesn't fall to one person. Humans make errors. And so the best way to handle that is to set up a system where we've got more checks and balances.
You know, you've mentioned a couple of times today, and also the governor and Commissioner Levine have talked about additional testing, and Mike Smith talking about it as well. The goal to have, I think, as many as 5,000 tests a day. Some people who are listening might be wondering, do I fall into the category of people who should think about getting a test? So could we just review very quickly, who should be getting a test at this point?
Sure. Our highest priority for people who should be getting a test are, of course, those who are displaying symptoms. those who have been identified as close contacts, again, a very high priority. There are some people who are part of groups that get surveillance testing, for example, staff at long-term care facilities. Right now, teachers should be getting tests on their regular schedule. Others who need to get a test are people who have traveled, for example, students who have come in for Thanksgiving or over the holidays. They should receive a test when they come. And then anyone who is concerned for any mix of those reasons should be getting a test. And finally, our additional category that we've really emphasized in the last couple of weeks is anyone who attended a multi-household social gathering. Another way of saying that is a party or a get-together or a barbecue or a dinner that had multiple guests outside of your home. You should also seek a test. All of those situations may put you at higher risk. And if you get a test, then we can know earlier and we can work with you and any of your contacts to hopefully contain it.
Let's talk to Doris in Burlington. Hi, Doris. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. This is great. These broadcasts are so helpful. I'm calling from Burlington Co-Housing on behalf of a committee. And the question is surrounding our future installation of ERVs, energy recovery ventilators. They should be installed in less than 2 weeks. And we are not sure as a group whether we can then treat ourselves as closer to being a restaurant. Our common dining room is big enough to have different households at separate tables far enough apart, or whether we shouldn't even think about doing that until we've all got vaccines. So we love our common meals. We would love to get back to them as soon as it's reasonable. Any suggestions?
Thanks for the question. It sounds like you might need to speak to someone involved in licensing restaurants. I don't know that I've got the background to be able to answer that. From a public health perspective, obviously anything you can do to mitigate risk is helpful. I can't speak to whether or not that affects your status as a bar or restaurant. And if you're asking a different question, maybe you could try again, because maybe I'm missing what you're asking me.
It's not an official bar restaurant. It's just that our air quality will be restaurant quality. Our ERVs are robust enough to give us enough fresh air, and we do have the space. So as a community, we don't want to be a restaurant, but does that give us any comfort in gathering back for being in the same big dining room and sharing a meal?
I might not have the best answer for you. I'd probably ask you to reach out either to the Commerce Department or maybe to the Food and Lodging Program at the Department of Health, and they might be able to get into your specifics a little more. I would feel hesitant to make a judgment right now based on not knowing a little more information.
Doris, thanks for your phone call. Let's turn to Katie in Waterbury. Hi, Katie. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, Katie. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I was just curious if you guys have any recommendations around riding in an elevator versus taking the stairwell.
That's a great question. So pre-pandemic, I would say you should go in the stairwell because that's better exercise. Now that we're in a pandemic, I would still say it'd be great to get in a stairwell if you can. It's better exercise. And of course, you're not as contained as in an elevator, but some people can't use the stairwell. And so if you have to go in an elevator, and if it opens up and there's someone in there, that's a fairly enclosed space. I'm not sure you can get 6 feet apart. So what I do is hold off and wait for the next elevator. The fewer the people, the better. Again, it's a relatively short amount of time. You know, you're probably only in there for a minute or so, but the fewer the better. And if you can afford to wait for an empty elevator, that's probably the better way to go if you need to take an elevator.
Katie, thanks very much for your phone call. We're almost out of time. Tracy, what percentage of folks are positive but are asymptomatic? I thought I heard something like 35 or 40%. Could it be that high?
We're hearing a range of answers on that. We have heard that it's as high as, you know, up to 40%. However, in Vermont, it doesn't appear that our current population is at that level. So I think you're asking, of all the people who are positive, maybe you're asking this, how many of those are asymptomatic? That becomes a little trickier to tell you. I do know that the CDC antibody tests are really telling. And when the CDC random samples people from all over the country, our state comes back with a rate well below 2% of the people who actually show antibodies. So even if people were asymptomatic, they should probably have an antibody response. So it's unlikely that in Vermont we have a high percentage of people generally who are positive with COVID-19, and therefore unlikely that we have a high percentage of people overall who are asymptomatic with COVID-19. But we do know that of those who have COVID-19, a proportion of those are asymptomatic. I can't tell you the percentage right now here in Vermont.
And one last thing, because we're almost out of time. Do you think if we're having this conversation in the middle of April, that most Vermonters who want to have a vaccine will be able to have one by then?
I am very hopeful. I mean, that's certainly how we're planning. Some things that could change that were if we had a very low uptake. That wouldn't change whether or not someone who wanted one got one, but it could change the trajectory of what we hope is a good trajectory for this illness. The other factor could be if there was some sort of challenge with manufacture. But as it stands now, Pfizer and Moderna both look like they are likely to get approval, and they both look like we should be moving to distribution. And hopefully in the spring, we will be able to get vaccines to everyone who wants them. And I hope that's really most people, most adults anyway. We might not be giving them to children because most of the trials are done on adults. But if we can get this vaccine out to adults, I know that I will be in line. My family will be in line. Dr. Levine, I'm sure, will get one on air. And I hope that encourages a lot of people to get it when it comes out, because we are confident in what we're seeing as the trials and the safety around this. It has been very fast, but it has not been skipped over. It's fast because a lot of people are working on it and they're able to fast track it, but they're not skipping steps. And we are confident in the safety of what we're seeing.
Well, that certainly will be a game changer for everybody. Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan, many thanks for taking the time to be with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, and I really appreciate all the questions from your callers. Take care.